Okay, welcome back to the second session today. I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Sally Tuffett, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Edinburgh. Sally's working on a project there about artisans and the craft economy in Scotland. Sally is also one of the course conveners for the Edmonton Dress and Textile History at the University of Glasgow. Her doctoral work examined clothing and textile cultures of 18th century Scotland, exploring production, dissemination and use of utilitarian and decorative dress. She's published articles on Scottish national dress and on the Scottish textile industry in the 19th century. Produced the latter while she was working as postdoctoral researcher on the Colouring the Nation project, which also produced an online exhibition. And Sally's going to speak to us today about, going to give us a paper with the title "The Workers Are the Only Losers, the Scottish Turkey Red Industry in the Late 19th Century."
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here. It's very exciting to be here. So, in December 2012, the Colouring the Nation project, for which I was the researcher, we held a show-and-tell workshop in the Vale of Leven in Dumbartonshire, which is just north of Glasgow. The workshop was a sort of antiques roadshow meets who do you think you are, because we wanted to meet people who had either worked in the once prosperous Turkey red cotton dyeing and printing industry, which had been a prominent feature of the local area from the 1830s up until 1961, as well as anyone who had a connection with the industry, either through a family member or just having lived in the area. Aside from the objects that the people brought in, two people who came along to the workshop stood out in particular. One was a woman called Annie Hussey, who you can see here. She was 99 at the time of the workshop and had worked for the United Turkey Red Company from the late 1920s through to the Second World War, often on night shifts. She'd worked in various departments over the years, including with the stenting machines, which were so loud that hand signals had to be used by the workers to communicate one another. And the one that she remembered most was they would make a circular motion around their face as though it's time to stop. She helped produce fabric which would be used for handkerchiefs and tablecloths, and remembered the managers checking the cloth for faults. If it wasn't good enough, it could be cut out and sold to the workers, which Annie says they often used for dresses. The second person was James Howard. He worked for the UTR for 10 months in 1946, doing the night shifts in the dye house, and like Annie, he remembered the processes of quality control conducted by the management. If the quality of dye wasn't good enough, it was sent back to be done again. Both Annie and James spoke with fondness of their time at the UTR, and their accounts, despite being based on work experiences of the 20th century, share some common themes with the information that can be uncovered about their predecessors working in the 19th century. Both spoke of the noise, the chemicals that were used, and the long hours, while their gender division of labour, James working in the dyeing section and Annie in the finishing department, reflected similar divisions that had existed since the 1830s. Both also spoke with a certain degree of affection for their managers and overseers, although there was still a clear sense of divide between the workers and their superiors. The nostalgia and rose-tinted perspective is almost to be expected. We all look back and tend to gloss over the worst things and focus on the good. But I was intrigued by their generally positive accounts of their work in this industry, which had been in the area for over 100 years, as it contrasted with the information we've come across regarding the workers and their own experiences in the history of the Scottish Turkey Red manufacture. This paper will explore some of the experiences of these workers, particularly those in the mid to late 19th century, trying to personalise what can seem like a large anonymous group of people. The workforce wasn't a specific component of the Colouring the Nation project. We were more focused on the textiles themselves, including the design processes and their various international markets. But it was impossible not to come across at least some fleeting references and information about the labour which was the driving force behind this industry, and who remain an intriguing and understudied aspect of it. But first, what exactly is Turkey Red? Turkey Red is a process which produces a bright red dye, typically on cotton cloth and yarn. It used natural alizarin, which was extracted from the madder root, along with mordants of oil and alum to fix the dye to the cloth. Other natural but unpleasant substances, including sheep's dung, bullock's blood and urine, were also used in the complex, secretive and lengthy process that gave a highly valued colour that didn't fade in sunlight or with washing. And it apparently could withstand up to 2 years in British sunlight without fading. Quite an achievement. Descriptions of the Turkey Red process vary greatly. Some are purposefully oblique, reflecting the secretive and competitive nature of the industry. Once a firm had figured out the complexities of it, they didn't want to hand over any advantage they had gained to any of their rivals. In simplified terms, though, there were five main stages, which between them could take up to 30 days to complete. And these stages were, first, cleaning or bleaching the cloth or yarn to remove impurities and prepare it for the dyeing process, In the early stages of the industry, this required prolonged periods of exposure to the sunlight and air with the cloth spread out on the ground. They would then prepare the cloth or yarn by saturating it with rancid olive oil in the sheep's dung. It would then be mordanted with alum to ensure that the dye stuff would take to the cloth. And then the dyeing would occur in large vats which contained the madder extract and the bullock's blood. And finally, it was cleaned and brightened by boiling in a solution of chloride of tin. And each step was repeated a number of times to complete the process. Western dyers had long been aware of the turkey red process, so-called because it was thought to have originated from the Levant region, but it wasn't until the late 18th century that the process was adopted and perfected by European dyers, first in Holland and France and then in Britain, establishing itself in Manchester and Glasgow. It was brought to Scotland by a Frenchman in 1785, who went into partnership with David Dale and George Mackintosh, and the process was quickly adopted by a number of manufacturers with factories on the banks of the River Clyde and in the Vale of Leven, all building on the suitability of the area and west of Scotland for cotton manufacture and taking advantage of the plentiful space, clean water supply and cheap labour pool. It became a large industry, employing thousands in the mid and later 19th century and producing millions of yards of dyed and printed cloth and yarn, which were exported across the world to places such as North America, Indonesia, the Far East and India. Three firms in particular came to dominate the industry. I'm sorry that the writing's now a bit small. Three firms dominated the Scottish industry: William Stirling and Sons, John Orr Ewing and Co, and Archibald Orr Ewing and Co. And these are where they were set up in the Vale of Leven. So just to the north you have Loch Lomond, and then the river runs down and it joins the River Clyde to the south, and Glasgow's sort of to the southeast. All three, as you can see, were based on the banks of the River Leven, and they were just a few miles apart, with offices in Glasgow and later Manchester. At their height, they employed between them approximately 6,000 people, many of whom were women and children, transforming a rural riverside area into a major industrial processing region in the space of a few years. Mid-19th century maps of the Vale show massive complexes of purpose-built structures, each with their own particular functions, such as dye houses, boiler houses, madder stores, necessary because it was delicate and susceptible to atmospheric damage, bleaching houses, washwheel houses, discharging houses, block printing and machine printing shops. The main product was plain red fabric and yarn, but they also produced printed cottons, employing a variety of techniques, including hand block printing, lead plate printing, copper plate and cylinder printing, each requiring workers of varying skills and abilities. The printed fabrics were sent all over the world, and they were used as saris, bandanas, commemorative handkerchiefs in the US elections, and various events of British national importance, such as the Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. And they were also used for quilted garments, such as this quilted petticoat you can see in the top right corner, even children's sewing costumes and household furnishings, and they were incorporated into working class clothing as handkerchiefs and aprons. The finished goods were not luxurious or high status, but they were meant to be attractive and durable, and they were typically affordable. And so they were part of a revolution in clothing dating back to the 18th century, based on cotton cloth, which saw people of lower social statuses becoming increasingly involved in fashionable consumption. The peak of the industry for the Scottish firms was in the 1860s to the 1880s, a period which saw workers in the Vale of Leven produce cloth with patterns ranging from simple polka dots to elephants, giraffes, steam trains, royalty and exotic flowers for sarongs in the South Pacific. Unfortunately, by the end of the 19th century, various factors were causing difficulties for the industry. They faced competition from manufacturers in Manchester, were being undermined by a resurgent Indian textile industry, which had previously been their main market, and the complex turkey red process itself was being increasingly undercut by cheaper and quicker synthetic dyes. As a protectionist measure, in 1898, the three main firms in the Vale of Leven, John Orr Ewing & Co., Archibald Orr Ewing & Co., which were run by two brothers, and William Stirling & Sons, amalgamated to form the United Turkey Red Company. Attempts were made to diversify, including making material for sandbags and camouflage printing during the Second World War, but the turkey red process was eventually superseded by quicker and cheaper methods. The UTR was taken over by the Calico Printers Association from Manchester in 1960, operations shifted to Manchester, and the final factory in the Vale closed in 1961. Very little survives of this once extensive industry. The factories have been torn down, leaving just the odd wall, the old gatepost, and street names. And occasionally we come across things that get fished out of the river. This was brought along for our workshop in December, and It looked like a dog bowl with the bottom that had fallen out of it, but it was hung from the ceiling, and the length of cloth would be passed through it during the process. It's from one department to another. And there are apparently quite a few that just are still getting fished out, because the Vale of Lee, the river, is now very clean, and it wasn't before, so it's good for fishing. The main source of evidence that we used for our project were the 200 pattern books that survive that are now held in the National Museums of Scotland, which contain a roughly 40,000 textile samples, ranging in size from a couple of centimetres to almost a metre squared. Unfortunately, these somewhat cryptic books don't give us much information about the people who use them, but there are some extant business records held in the Scottish Business Archive at the University of Glasgow and in the Manchester County Record Office, reflecting the shifting centre of operations from Scotland to Manchester at the turn of the 20th century. While these records are patchy, they do give snippets of information which, when pieced together with newspapers and other publications, offer some insight into the workers' experience of the Turkey Red industry. So, thanks to the 19th century trend for publications on eminent personages, family businesses, and histories of local areas, one of the first impressions received about the Turkey Red industry is that of the paternalistic attitudes of the industry's owners and their partners. It was often noted, for instance, that the villages and towns of the Vale of Leven would not exist were it not for these men, and this was true on a number of levels. They had established successful businesses which in turn attracted people to the area, and they were also responsible for most of the infrastructure of the region. While the modern conveniences, such as gas lighting and railways, certainly had their advantages, there were mixed feelings about the changing landscape. James Barr, a pattern maker at Archibald or Ewing's Levenbank Works in the mid-19th century, wrote that the whole face of the country is now changed, and bemoaned the fact that there were once grassy fields for bleaching cloth and pasture for cattle were now covered in huge brick monstrosities with tall chimneys vomiting clouds of smoke and vapour that obscure the skies. On the other hand, he observed that a much greater number now find the means of subsistence, and there may possibly be a proportionate amount of wealth, comfort and happiness in the district. He went on to say that with the facilities afforded by the railways and telegraphs, a higher standard of education, and a greatly developed means of acquiring knowledge, the external conditions of happiness are decidedly in favour of the present. Barr's account sums up quite the key developments instigated by the Turkey Red owners, which has been interpreted by some as being powerful and explicit endeavours to extend their authority in the workplace to all corners of local life. To accommodate his workers at the Milton and Levenbank works, for instance, Archibald or Ewing built three long rows of two-roomed apartments with dry middens, ash pits and communal washhouses. He also built a school, a public hall and met half the cost of a new kirk, increasing the layout of Jamestown substantially. He also built the Jamestown Institute, where his workers could spend their hours both pleasantly and profitably, leading one observer to note that Archibald or Ewing had recognised that employers of labour have duties as well as privileges to enjoy. Recently, these philanthropic gestures have been called into question somewhat when it's noted that the provision of the housing reflected the division of labour within the Turkey Red Works. Skilled workers were the ones who were given the company houses, while the unskilled workers had to live in more deprived areas without the benefits of this newly built accommodation. And as with most industries, it was the unskilled labour force that made up the majority of the workers. Sir Archibald or Ewing, as he became known in 1886, also participated in public works in Glasgow. He contributed to the fund that built Glasgow University's Gilmore Hill and sat on various boards. He stood for Parliament in 1868, holding the seat for Dumbartonshire for 24 years, and he was described as the considerate and philanthropic employer of all, or almost all, who reside in the village of Jamestown. And an example of his benevolence that's often cited was his granting of a day's holiday to his workers in 1878 to celebrate the marriage of his daughter. Other partners and owners were not to be outdone. Archibald's older brother and business rival, John, donated 100 tons of coal to the deserving poor in the region, and he also had housing constructed near to his printworks. India Street, which you can see here, is one of the few that still remains and is right next to the main gate of the works. James Black & Co., one of the smaller firms, built the Dalmonnock Schoolhouse in the 1830s, and again this was right next door to the printworks, and is now the only surviving structure of this firm. While John Hyde Christie, who started off as a partner in John Orr Ewing & Co. and then became the first general manager of UTR, immortalised his name by gifting Christie Park to the residents of Alexandria in 1902. He also served on various local councils and worked hard to advance the interests of the industry in the face of increasing competition and technological advances. The manager's and owner's connection to the area was further promoted by a more or less continued residency in the area, in accommodation which was naturally much grander than the abodes of the workers. John Hyde Christie, senior partner, lived in Leavenfield House in Alexandria, which was later used as offices for the UTR, and Alexander Wiley of William Sterling and Sons took up residence in Cordell House in Renton, right next door to the Cordell Works. Neither were the partners wise to be left out. One account written in the 1880s noted that the prosperity of the village of Renton was entirely due to the extensive operations of the ancient and honourable firm of Messrs. William Sterling and Sons, and spoke in glowing terms of the personal efforts of Alexander Wiley's wife. She was apparently very concerned with the condition of the villagers, put on concerts and entertainments, as well as providing more practical support through clothing societies for the poor, teaching needlework and knitting, and setting up a weekly mothers' meeting. Her husband was born and raised in the Vale, perhaps accounting for his close relationship with the workers and inhabitants. He was chair of the parochial school board, played an active role in adult education, contributed to the local literary society, a mechanics institute, and was the honourable president of the Renton Football Club, which had been formed in 1873, along with a number of other local teams and with a lot of players coming from the Turkey Red Works. One observer noted that Wiley held very enlightened and advanced views on the relationship that should exist between the master and men, and felt that an employer of labour has duties to perform besides paying them wages. He therefore encouraged his workers to invest in the co-op, in the local friendly societies, and in the penny bank. This impression of workers and owners living and residing in harmony does quite naturally seem too good to be true, and somewhat contradicts what we can gather about the day-to-day lives of the workers themselves from other sources. As with any industry, there's a clear divide between the skilled and unskilled tasks involved in the Turkey Red process. And considering the numbers of workers involved, it's not surprising that many of them remain anonymous to the historical record. Skilled workers, such as pattern designers, have been slightly easier to extract from the mass, albeit fleetingly. One appears simply as a signature of James Lindsay in an undated pattern book, while we know that there were four pattern drawers in one of the Vale firms in 1845, the highest paid of whom was a man called William Brock, who earned £8 a month. The Vale of Leven firms relied heavily on design copying and adaptation, often leading to disputes and outright accusations of design theft, but reliable designers and pattern drawers were still highly desirable. Archibald Orr Ewing & Co., for instance, advertised for a designer of first-rate taste and ability, practically acquainted with the working of Turkey Red printed goods, in 1855. Similar advertisements appeared throughout the 1850s, which was a time of significant expansion for the industry, although they didn't often name the employer involved, perhaps because the firm did not want to show its competitors that it was looking for fresh talent. Individuals in these trades would also advertise themselves as being available for work, including men who were based in the Manchester Turkey Red industry but were willing to relocate to Glasgow. Such adverts were also anonymous, with contact only available through the newspaper or post office boxes. Some pattern designers appear to have been following a family trade. Tom McEwen, for instance, was later an artist of Scottish landscapes and genre scenes. His father had been a foreman pattern designer at Inglis and Wakefield, which was a Manchester firm that had some operations in Glasgow. McEwen Jr. became an apprentice with another Glasgow firm, and after 14 years of working in the textile design industry, he became a full-time painter, working in Scotland and in London. Another pattern designer who found success upon leaving the industry was John Buchanan, who worked in the Vale and then for a Glasgow-based firm that was noted for its bandanas and floral designs. It's likely that he attended some of the classes at the Glasgow School of Design, which had been established in 1845, before he emigrated to New Zealand in the 1850s, where he made a reputation as a botanist and botanical artist. The block cutters, producing patterns for the foreign and domestic markets, are even more anonymous in the historical record, but we do know a little about one. Archibald Aitken was a block cutter for Archibald Orr Ewing & Co. in the 1880s. His block cutting tools were passed down to his son, who also worked for the firm, and then on to his granddaughter, along with the strike-off, which you can see on the top right here, which was a dry run to show that the block would work properly on the fabric. According to his granddaughter, this design was called the King among the family, most likely because Archibald Aitken, born and bred in the west of Scotland in the middle of the 19th century, had no reason to suppose otherwise. He saw the crown and assumed it was a man, rather than in actual fact being a woman in a sari. This was one of the rare moments where a chain of sources across different institutions linked together. From the strike-off and the tools, we were able to ascribe Archibald Aitken to the woodblock, which still survives in the collection of West Dunbartonshire Museums. And then we came across the finished textile sample among the pattern books in the National Museums of Scotland. which meant we were able to identify what was an anonymous pattern book as being part of Archibald or Ewing & Co.'s work. Unskilled labour was typically provided by the women and the children, and they were even more hidden from view than the skilled milled workers. But we can use the Turkey Red process itself to access some information about their experiences. In a rare written record in the form of a wage book, for instance, we know that a young lad called Peter Davy was paid £1.10 for spending 12 days tramping on large amounts of sheep's dung, presumably to break it down for the solution for the undyed cloth needed to be soaked in. During the actual dyeing of the cloth, the madder extract was combined with the bullock's blood, which seems to have been for more alchemical purposes than for any real reason. William Stirling and Sons got through 130,000 gallons of bull's blood a year, and it was advertised in the abattoirs, by the abattoirs in the local press as being a product particularly suitable for the Turkey Red industry. The blood was supplied in wooden barrels, providing a source of irritation for the workers in the industry, particularly in the heat of the summer months when the poorly made barrels did little to contain the stench. The blood was added to the dye vats for the cloth or yarn to be soaked in. Not unexpectedly, the exposed skin of the workers' hands was often tinged with colour from handling the cloth and the yarn. And this is an image from the early 20th century showing young women from the Dillychip Works, formerly part of Archibald or Ewing & Co., but at this point part of the UTR. And it's hard to tell from the image, but the ones that aren't hiding their hands, you can see that the colour of the skin on their hands is significantly darker than elsewhere, and probably from the dye. And I love this picture as well because they're obviously dressed in their nice clothes for the photo, but you can still see they're wearing their work hobnail boots and trying to hide their hands away. Turkey Red was a labour-intensive process which required night shifts and weekend works to ensure continuity in the production line, a pattern of work which, as we know from Annie Hussey and James Howard, continued well into the 20th century. As soon as the process was known in Scotland, manufacturers made changes and adaptations to try and reduce the time needed and thus boost profits. While some improvements were made over the course of the 19th century, it still remained labour-intensive and continued to place high demand on its workers, not least in the hours that they were expected to work. The introduction of the Factory Acts to limit working hours in the latter part of the 19th century, therefore, was met with pleas for exemption from the veil of leave in employers. Archibald or Ewing, using his status as MP for Dumbartonshire, as well as his knowledge of the Turkey Red industry, gave evidence to a Factory Acts commission in 1875. At that time, he employed 1,728 people, a reduction he estimated of between 50 and 75% since he'd joined the industry in 1835, thanks to increased mechanisation, but still a significant number. Orr Ewing stressed the exceptional nature of the Turkey Red industry, which at his firm still required more than 20 separate processes over a period of 26 days. So this is 90 years after it came to Scotland, but they've only managed to shorten it by 4 days when it first appeared. The Commission was proposing a reduction in working hours on Saturdays, a suggestion which Orr Ewing argued would be severely detrimental to the industry. The Turkey Red manufacturers had already been granted an exemption in 1870, which meant that they did not have to give their workers a half day on Saturday. Defending this privilege and wishing to maintain it, Orr Ewing argued that the combustible nature of the project meant that it could not be left for too long on its own. This point was well taken by the Commission. He then perhaps went a step too far by arguing that if Turkey Red workers were granted a half day on Saturdays, it would lead to, quote, idle habits of which we already have sufficient in the country. This generated less sympathy from the Commission. And it's a telling indication of how the Turkey Red viewers viewed their own workforce and contradicts somewhat the contemporary commentaries which lauded the owners for their paternalistic oversight of the industry and the community. Correspondence between the three main Vale of Leven firms shows that they were more than aware of the limitations of the Factory Act and that they were happy to work around them as much as possible. One way was to import extra labour. In 1873, both William Stirling and Sons and John Orr Ewing & Co. brought in women from Ireland to fill the gaps that the Factory Act had created by preventing women from working overtime. John Orr Ewing & Co. wrote to priests in Ireland offering wages from 9 to 13 shillings a week, and the company was willing to pay their travel fare to Scotland and cited the flourishing Catholic chapel and school in the district as a further incentive for the women to come over. The numbers don't seem to be huge, but it's perhaps not entirely a coincidence that at the same time some of the workers of John Orr Ewing & Co. went on strike. By 1879, it seems that the industry leaders were quite confident that they could work around the Act. The managers of John Orr Ewing & Co. wrote to Archibald Orr Ewing & Co. stating, "We are glad there is nothing new in the Factory Act, as we read it, to prohibit us working our warehouse hands more than 56 hours a week, And if you look to the exemptions, we will find we can work 10 hours per day for the first 5 days of the week and until 4:30 on Saturdays. Section 47 says, in the process of Turkey Red dying, nothing in Part 1 of this Act shall prevent the employment of young persons and women on Saturdays until 4:30. Section 11 says, the period of employment except on Saturdays shall be at 6 in the morning and end at 6 in the evening. They then ended with, we have therefore made no changes to our working hours. When the factory acts became more strict and more restrictive, they simply decreased the wages, while still expecting the same level of production from their workers. Shortly after they'd written this letter, 600 women went on strike to protest their reduced wages, but they were eventually forced to come back and accept a 5% reduction. This was one of the larger strikes in the Vale. Others, though frequent, were on a relatively small scale and seemed to have been short-lived. Motivations for striking were generally low wages or the introduction of short time, where production and hours were reduced to cope with wider market pressures. In 1878, which was a relatively difficult time for the industry thanks to the rising prices of artificial alizarin, which was being monopolised by the German manufacturers, and various factory acts, there was a debate over the benefits of introducing short time over reducing the workers' wages. A letter written on behalf of John R. Ewing to his manager, John Christie, stated that Mr. Ewing had decided it would be the better course to adopt short time and reduce output, because curtailing production would have the effect of improving markets, while continuing to produce our full quality each, even with a reduction of wages, is only keeping the markets as fully supplied as ever, and in the end giving the benefit of any reduction of wages to the buyer, thus depriving ourselves of any advantage, while the workers are the only losers. On the one hand, while this does show some consideration for the workers and their lot, it was clearly a secondary factor when compared with the firm's overall success in the wider marketplace. Striking wasn't the only recourse available to the workers. In 1870, the management of John R. Ewing & Co. received a petition from their joiners asking for an advance in wages. They were currently being paid 27 shillings for a 57-hour week, and the management felt that this was quite high enough. To cover their backs, though, they wrote to the other firms in the Vale just to check how much they were paying their joiners. The response doesn't survive, but a further letter written to the joiners refusing to raise their wages would suggest that the other firms were paying the same rates. The three firms corresponded regularly with one another over the issue of wages and strikes. For the former, they knew that they had to match each other or they would lose their workers to the rival firms down the road. And when it came to strikes, they would write to warn each other that the trouble was brewing. There is evidence that the Turkey Red firms would also use intimidation and or threats to keep hold of their workers. In an industry which relied on secrecy to maintain an edge over their competitors, having a knowledgeable workforce was both an asset and a disadvantage. As an asset, they knew the business and what was required from their particular position, while on the other hand, their knowledge meant that they were a potential source of information for the rival firms. The standard apprenticeship indenture at James Black & Co., for instance, included the wording, he shall by no means reveal or discover to any person or persons whatever any secrets or mysteries relating to any branch or branches of the company's business. This secrecy continues even today. Documents in the Paisley archives can only be consulted with permission from the current owners, which is a thread and dye company. And there are plenty of examples of design theft and industrial espionage which show that they were right to be concerned and protective of their property. Keeping the wages competitive ensured the workers were not tempted to move from one firm to another and potentially take their knowledge and trade secrets with them. In 1906, it was reported that a girl intended to leave the Croftingay Works, which were owned by John R. Ewing, to fill a situation in another works and district. The day previous to her going away, the foreman came to her and said, "Your notice is withdrawn and you must stay where you are, or if you persist in going, your brother and father will have to go too." Having family members working for different firms was clearly not acceptable. Who knew what trade secrets would be shared over the dinner table? In another example, a young man applied for a situation in an engraving shop in Glasgow. He got the job, but while working out his notice, one of the partners asked him where he was going. A few days later, he received a letter from his new employer saying that the job had been cancelled. They'd received word from the Vale of Leven that had warned him off him. This would make it seem like all the cards were held by the managers rather than the workers, but the workers knew they could exploit the system at least to a certain extent. The evidence from the second half of the 19th century shows that workers quite often flitted between one firm and the other, often to avoid being put on short time or sometimes it seemed simply for a change of scene. This practice obviously caused great consternation to the management. Gentlemen's agreements not to hire workers from other factories were in place, but unsurprisingly they weren't always honoured. they didn't want to lose their own workers, but they were quite happy to take somebody else's if they turned up on the doorstep. In one instance, it seems that foremen working for Archibald or Ewing & Co. visited workers of John or Ewing & Co. in their homes after the working day to try and persuade them to switch sides. Aside from the long working hours, other information is available about the working conditions of the Turkey Red factories. Returning to Archibald or Ewing's testimony to the Factory Act Commission, we can get some information about a specific part of the workforce, the stove women. In an industry which engaged all manners of workers and involved numerous processes, from dyeing, printing and shipping, it's only to be expected that some jobs were more arduous than others, and the stove workers seem to have had a particularly hard time. These stoves were in constant use because of the repeated and multiple steps of the Turkey Red process, meant that there was always some yarn or some cloth that needed drying before it could proceed to the next stage. In a statement to the Factory Acts Commission, Archibald or Ewing maintained, however, that the stove workers had a relatively easy task. For instance, when other workers were expected to stay until 6, they were often allowed to leave as early as 4. He continued, "The temperature in some of our stoves is sometimes as high as 180 degrees, but the girls don't work in them when the temperature is above 80 or 100. It is not arduous labour, and they are among their most healthy in the works. Working among oiled cloth seems to agree with them." The stoves are often mentioned in the accounts of the Turkey Red works, and despite Archibald or Ewing's assertions to the contrary, these references highlight the dangers of working in such conditions. In the same Factories Act Commission, for instance, evidence was given by a bleacher from Pollock Shores near Glasgow, which said that there were about 50 women and one man working in the stoves, where the heat will sometimes be 115 degrees. But there was no work to take them out of this heated room, so they constantly stayed in there, and such conditions were detrimental to their health. The stoves were obviously also a fire hazard, and sizable conflagrations were a common occurrence. In 1855, one of the smaller Turkey Red manufacturers of Glasgow had a fire which originated in the drying store. Attention was called to it when the Turkey Red girls working upstairs noticed a sudden rise in temperature, and one of the workers died. Others did extensive damage to the works. In 1859, in the Blantyre Cotton Works, a fire originated in the drying store, where 4,000 pounds of yarn were hung out to dry. Two large buildings were completely gutted, and in an indication of the size of these works, the night workers in another part of the complex were said to be completely ignorant of the blaze until it was almost put out. William Stirling and Sons had no less than 4 fires in the space of 6 months at their Dalhung dyeing works, all of which were reported widely in the press, in the Scottish press, and the last of them reportedly caused over £10,000 worth of damage. Other dangers were presented by the substances that were being used. With the discovery of mauve in 1856, the first aniline dye, the textile dyeing industry was changed forever. For the Turkey Red industry, the main step came with the synthesizing of alizarin in 1868 by German chemists. The industry, which was already using noxious and pungent substances for the printing processes, became increasingly reliant on chemicals, often to the detriment to the health of the workers. In 1881, men at John or Ewing's factory were suffering from swelling and pustules on their arms and hands, poisoned by an unknown substance. One man had to have his finger amputated because the swelling got so severe. And a number of letters to the Glasgow infirmary asking them to admit workers for various ailments, which are never really described, survive in a letter book from John or Ewing & Co. A later report complained that the windows were only ever open for ventilation when the factory inspectors were coming for a visit. The machinery also presented dangers, and from these, I'm sorry they're so small, but if I blew them up even bigger, they become grainy and you can't see them at all. These are from the Dalmonic printing works of James Black & Co. in the 1860s. Margaret Patterson injured her hand while cleaning a machine that was still moving, an action which the company said it had warned its workers not to do. John or Ewing & Co. maintained that Patterson knew she shouldn't clean the machine while it was in motion, and that she had in fact put her hand in after looking around to check that there was no foreman nearby to tell her off for doing it. A few months later, she was able to return to work, having been given a voluntary allowance by the firm during her recovery. Either John or Ewing & Co. was indeed at fault for this, or this is an example of, or one of the few examples of their generosity towards their workers. Other accidents were fatal. In 1886, a year after Patterson injured her hand, another female worker for John or Ewing & Co. sat next to a set of steam cans to warm herself up after the walk into work. Her shawl got caught on moving machinery, dragging her into it and entangling her hair and scalping her. She died from shock shortly afterwards. No record has survived of this company's reaction to this incident, but on a number of occasions where the death of the worker had occurred, some effort was made to provide for the family that was left behind. two widows of workers who had died in a building accident in 1876 at John Orr Ewing & Co's Alexandria plant were given a pension and assistance in sending their children to school, at least until 1888 when the records end. In another example, Mrs. Quinn, who was recently widowed, was told that the firm would provide for her, while also being told that her husband alone had been to blame for the unspecified accident. Although it has been argued that the creation of the UTR in 1898 killed off the paternalistic nature that had been established by the original firms of the Turkey Red industry, there are examples of some benevolent acts made by the UTR. Interestingly, however, they still do not cater to the working conditions of the employees, more to their lives outside the works, and demonstrate a more nationalistic and patriotic bent. In 1899, the UTR board agreed that any wives or families of men who were serving in the reserves for the army in the Boer War were to receive a bonus from the company, as if the said employees had continued in the company's service. A further motion was called that any men returning from having served in the war would be reinstated, if not in their old position, then one as near as possible. It would seem, however, that into the 20th century conditions had not improved, and if anything they were worse, contributing to a major strike in 1911. One worker described having to carry 25 pounds of cotton hanks up and down five flights of stairs, earning just 10 shillings 6 pence a week and working 12-hour days. Another worker had holes in her big toes from repeatedly standing in puddles of chemicals, and if the factory inspector came to visit, anyone with damaged hands was made to stand behind the machines out of sight. Workers still made effort to get their wages increased, but this was met either with blank refusal or with provisos and threats that more work would be undertaken. One response, which again refers to the stove women, was that this demand was considered today, and I am advised to inform you that the advance is being conceded. The advance, however, is granted on the understanding that each girl carry from the dye house, spread, carry into the stove, hang, take out of the stove, and convey to the conditioning shed at least £1,000 a day. I am instructed to ask that you will see the above quantity is obtained from each girl, and that when production is reduced, the number of stove women will be reduced also. Working in the Turkey Red industry was long and arduous, generally poorly paid, and often dangerous. But this tends to be forgotten in the histories and stories that are told in the Vale of Leven. There is a pride in the industry that is still evident today. Once the last factory closed in 1961, a number of other industries moved into the area, including a car factory. But none were as long-lasting as Turkey Red, and none seem to have reached the same level of employment. Today is an area of low employment, which is perhaps why the Turkey Red industry is remembered so fondly, as the heyday of the region, and for being the reason why so many families were brought there in the first place, and whose descendants remain in the Vale today. The Colouring the Nation project has contributed to this optimistic perception of the industry, although we didn't do this on purpose. We focused on the bright colours and exotic designs that the Turkey Red industry produced, intrigued by the notion that this small area in the Vale of Leven produced printed cloth that appeared in handkerchiefs on the American frontier, as saris in India, as sarongs in Africa and the South Pacific, and as decorative printed fabrics in the Middle East. The fleeting references to the workers that do survive, however, reveal a much darker story, and one that is by no means unique in the 19th century British context, but still merits further investigation.